Pino glanced in the mirror, feared a tongue lashing, but found the general looking coldly at him. Liar said, "Your ancestors invented what's going to happen."
Mon général?
The ancient Romans called it decimation for Arbeiter. They used it throughout their empire. The problem with decimation is that the tactic never works for long.
I don't understand.
Decimation functions psychologically, Lyris explained. It's designed to quell the threat of revolt through abject fear. But historically, using brutality against civilians in reprisal breeds more hatred than obedience.
Brutality? Pino thought. Reprisals? The violent acts Lyris warned the cardinal about? What were they going to do to Tullio and the others?
Would telling General Lyris that Tullio was his close friend help, or... In the streets parallel to them, he heard the blaring of loudspeakers. The man spoke in Italian, calling all concerned citizens to Piazzale Loreto. Two companies of black-shirt fascists had cordoned off the rotary, but they waved the lorries and General Lyris's car through. The lorries drove toward Beltramini's fresh fruits and vegetables, stopped just shy of it, backed up, and turned, so the vehicle's backs faced the blank common wall, where several buildings joined.
"Drive on around the rotary," Lyris said.
As Pino drove past the fruit stand, the awning still torn, he flashed on the bomb going off there. He was shocked to see Carletto coming out of the shop, staring at the lorries, and then starting to look his way. Pino hit the accelerator and got quickly out of sight. 3/4 of the way around the rotary, Lyris ordered Pino to pull into the Esso station, the one with the big iron girder system above the petrol pumps. An attendant came out nervously.
"Tell him to fill the tank and that we are going to park here," Lyris said.
Pino told the man, who looked at the general's flags and scurried away. With the loudspeakers still calling, the people of Milan came at a trickle of a curious few at first, but then the flow of new arrivals built to a steady stream of pedestrians, coming into Piazzale Loreto from all directions. Black shirts put up wooden barriers from the fruit stand west 30 meters, and to either side of the lorries heading north 45 meters. As a result, there was a large open space around the lorries, with a crowd building at the fences. Pino soon figured out there were 1,000 people, maybe more, halfway between the 150 meters that separated the Daimler from Tullio's lorry. A second Nazi staff car appeared, pulled to the edge of the rotary, and stopped. From this distance and angle, Pino could not tell who was in the car. More people streamed into the piazza, so many that they soon blocked the view.
"I can't see," General Lyris said.
"No, mon général," Pino said.
Lyris paused, looked out the window, and said, "Can you climb?" A minute later, Pino stepped off the top of the petrol pump and pulled himself up onto one of the low girders. He held tight to an iron post and a second girder at head height.
"Can you see?"
General Lyris asked from below, standing by the staff car.
"Oui, mon général."
Pino had a clear, unobstructed view over the heads of the 1,500 people now in the piazza. The lorries were still there, flaps closed.
"Help me up there," Lyris said.
Pino looked down, saw the general had already climbed onto one of the pumps, his hand outstretched. Pino helped hoist him up. Lyris hung on to the overhead cross girder, while Pino hugged the post. In the distance, the Duomo's bells rang the hour 9 times. The black shirt commander from the prison yard climbed down from the cab of the nearby lorry. The fascist disappeared from Pino's view behind the other lorry, the one holding the prisoners. Soon the 15 began to stream out, one by one, going to the wall to the right of the fruit stand, shoulder to shoulder, facing toward the crowd, which was growing uneasy. Tullio was the 7th man out. By then, Pino knew in his gut what was about to happen, if not how, and he had to wrap his arms around the steel post to keep from falling. The empty lorry pulled away. The crowd gave it room, and the transport vehicle was soon gone onto the rotary. Hooded black-shirt gunmen poured out the back of the other transport, and then it was driven away as well. Armed with machine pistols, the fascist commandos lined up no more than 15 meters from the prisoners. A black shirt shouted, "Every time a communist partisan kills a German soldier or a soldier of the Salo army, there will be swift punishment with no mercy." The piazza fell quiet, but for murmurs of disbelief. One of the prisoners began shouting at the fascists and the firing squad. It was Tullio. "You cowards!" Tullio roared at them. "You traitors! You do the Nazis' dirty work and hide your faces! You're all a bunch of..." The machine pistols opened up, cutting Tullio down first. Pino's friend danced backward with the bullet impacts, and then sprawled slack on the sidewalk. Chapter 18 1 Pino screamed and screamed into the crook of his arm as the shooting went on and more men fell. The crowd went mad, crying in horror and stampeding to get away from the machine gunners who sprayed the walls of Piazzale Loreto with blood and gore that dripped and pooled around the 15 martyrs long after the gunfire had stopped. Eyes closed, Pino slid down and straddled the lower girder, hearing the screams in Piazzale Loreto as if they were far away and muffled. "The world doesn't work like this," he tried to tell himself. "The world is not sick and evil like this." He remembered Father Ray summoning him to a higher cause, and then found himself reciting the Hail Mary, the prayer for the dead and the dying. He'd gotten to the last line, "Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our..."
"Vorarbeiter! God damn it!" General Lyers shouted. "Do you hear me?"
In a daze, Pino looked around and up at the Nazi, who was still standing on the girder, his face stony and cold.
"Get down," Lyers said. "We're leaving."
Pino's first thought was to pull the general's feet out from under him, have him fall on his back on concrete from more than 4 meters up. Then he'd jump down and strangle him with his bare hands, just to make sure. Lyers had let this atrocity happen. He'd stood by when I said, "Get down." Feeling like a part of his mind had been permanently burned, he did so. Lyers climbed down after him and got into the back of the Daimler. Pino shut his door and slid behind the wheel.
"Where to, mon général?" Pino asked numbly.
"Did you know one of them?" Lyers asked.
"I heard you screaming."
Pino hesitated, his eyes welling with tears.
"No," he said finally. "I've just never seen anything like that before."
The general studied him in the rearview mirror a moment before saying,
"Go. There's nothing more to be done here."
The other German staff car was already turning around, heading for the checkpoint, when Pino started the Daimler. The rear window of the second staff car was down. He could see Colonel Ralph looking out at them. Pino wanted to floor the accelerator and T-bone the Gestapo chief's car. Ralph's vehicle would be no match for the Daimler. Maybe he'd even kill Ralph, make the world an infinitely better place. General Lyers said,
Wait until they've gone ahead. Pino watched Colonel Ralph disappear into the city before he started the Daimler.
Where to, mon général? He said again, unable to stop seeing Tullio rage against his executioners before dancing on the bullets that killed him.
Hotel Regina, Lyre said.
Pino started in that direction.
If I may, mon général, what will happen to the bodies?
They'll lie there until dark, when their relatives can claim them.
All day?
Colonel Ralph wants the rest of Milan, especially the partisans, to see what happens when German soldiers are killed,
Lyers said as they left the checkpoint.
These savage idiots. Don't they see this will just increase the number of Italians who want to kill German soldiers? You, Vorarbeiter, do you want to kill Germans? Do you want to kill me?
Pino was shocked by the question, and he wondered if the man could read his mind. But he shook his head, said,
No, mon général. I want to live in peace and prosperity like anyone.
The Nazis' plenipotentiary for war production fell silent and pensive, while Pino drove back to Gestapo headquarters. Lyers got out and said,
You have 3 hours.
2. Pino dreaded the task ahead, but he left the Daimler and tore off his swastika armband. He went to the new purse store, but the girl who worked there said his father had gone over to Albanese luggage. When Pino entered the leather goods shop, Michele, Uncle Albert, and Aunt Greta were the only ones inside. His uncle saw him, rushed out from behind the counter.
Where the hell have you been? We've been worried sick.
You didn't come home, his father said.
Oh, thank God you're back.
Aunt Greta took one look at Pino and said,
What's happened?
For a few moments, Pino couldn't say a word. Then he fought back tears as he said,
The Nazis and the fascists, they did a decimation at San Vittore in retaliation for the bombing. They counted off every 10th man until they got 15. Then they took them to the Piazzale Loreto and machine-gunned them to death.
He broke down.
Tullio was one of them.
Uncle Albert and his father looked gut-shot. Aunt Greta said,
That's not true. You must have seen someone else.
Pino, crying, said,
It was him. Tullio was so brave, yelling at the men who were about to shoot him, calling them cowards, and, oh God, it was horrible.
He went to his father and hugged him, while Uncle Albert held Aunt Greta, who had turned hysterical.
I hate them, she said. My own people, and I hate them.
When she'd calmed down, Uncle Albert said,
I'll have to go tell his mother.
She can't get Tullio's body until sundown, Pino said. They're keeping the bodies on display as a warning of what happens when partisans kill Germans.
The pigs, his uncle said. This changes nothing. It only makes us stronger.
That's what General Lyers said would happen.
By noon, Pino was sitting on the steps of La Scala, where he could see the front of the Hotel Regina and the Daimler parked nearby. He was numb with grief. Gazing across the street at the statue of the great Leonardo and listening to the chatter of citizens who hurried past, he wanted to cry again. Everyone was talking about the atrocity. More than a few called Piazzale Loreto a cursed place now. He was seeing it all again and again in his mind, and he agreed. At 3 o'clock, Lyers finally emerged from Gestapo headquarters. He got into the car, told Pino to drive to the telephone exchange yet again. There Pino waited, and thought about Tullio. Merciful night began to fall. Pino felt a little better, knowing that his friend's body could be retrieved and readied for burial. At 7, the general exited the telephone exchange, got in the back of the staff car, and said, "Dolly's." Pino parked in front of her place on the Via Dante. Lyers had him carry the locked valise. The crone in the lobby blinked behind her glasses and seemed to sniff after them as they passed and climbed up the stairs to Dolly's apartment. When Anna opened the door, he could see she was upset.
"Are you in for the night, General?" Anna asked.
"No," he said. "I'm thinking of taking Dolly out for dinner."
Dolly came to the hallway in a dressing robe, a highball glass in one hand, and said,
"A perfect idea. I go crazy sitting here all day, waiting for you, Hans. Where shall we go?"
"That place around the corner," Lyer said. "We can walk. I feel like I need to."
He paused, and then looked at Pino.
"You can stay here, Vorarbeiter, and eat. When I return, I'll tell you whether I have further need of you tonight."
Pino nodded and sat on the bench. Looking unhappy, Anna bustled through the dining area, ignoring Pino as she passed, and saying,
"What shall I lay out for you, Dolly?"
General Lyers followed, and they all vanished into the depths of the apartment. None of it seemed real to Pino. Lyers was going on as if he'd not seen 15 people murdered in cold blood that morning. There was something reptilian about the general, he decided. Lyers could watch men jerking on bullets and spurting blood in the last moments of their lives, and then he could go out to eat with his mistress. Anna returned, and as if it were a chore, said,
"You hungry, Vorarbeiter?"
"Per favore. If it's a bother, no, signorina," Pino said, not looking at her.
After a few moments' pause, the maid sighed and said in a different tone,
"It's not a bother, Pino. I can heat something up for you."
"Thanks," he said, still not looking at Anna, because he'd noticed the general's valise at his feet and was wishing he'd learned to pick a lock. He heard raised, muffled voices, Lyers and his mistress having an argument of some kind. He raised his head, saw the maid was gone. A door banged open. Dolly passed the hallway where Pino sat. She called,
"Anna!"
Anna hurried into the dining and living area.
"Yes, Dolly?"
Dolly said something in German that the maid seemed to understand, because she left quickly. The general reappeared, dressed in his uniform pants, shoes, and a sleeveless undershirt. Pino sprang to his feet. Lyers ignored him, came out into the living area, and said something to Dolly in German. She replied curtly, and he disappeared for several minutes, while his mistress poured herself a whiskey and smoked by the window. Pino felt odd inside, as if something about Lyers just then had caught his eye, but had not fully registered. What was it? When the general returned, he wore a freshly ironed shirt and a tie. His jacket was tossed over one shoulder.
"We will be back in a couple of hours," Lyers told Pino, passing closely by.
He stared after the general and Dolly, feeling that oddness again, and then tried to remember Lyers from just a few minutes before, shirtless and... "Oh my God," he thought. 3. The door shut. Pino heard a board creak. He pivoted his head and saw Anna standing there.
"I heard a grocer say that 15 members of the resistance were shot in Piazzale Loreto this morning," she said, wringing her hands. "Is that true?"
"Sick all over again," he said,
I saw it. My friend was one of them. Anna covered her mouth.
Oh, you poor thing. Please, come to the kitchen. There's schnitzel, gnocchi, and garlic butter. I'll open one of the general's best wines. He'll never know.
Very soon, a place was set at a small table at the end of a galley kitchen that was spotless. A candle burned there, too. Anna sat opposite him, sipping a glass of wine. Veal? Pino thought, as he sat down and smelled the divine aroma wafting up from his plate. When was the last time he'd had veal? Before the bombardment? He took a bite.
Oh, he groaned. That is so good.
Anna smiled.
My grandmother, God rest her, she taught me that recipe.
He ate. They talked. He told her about the scene at the Piazzale Loreto, and she hung her head and held it for a while with both hands. When she lifted her head to look at Pino, her eyes were bloodshot and filmy.
How do men think of such wickedness?
Anna asked as wax dripped down the candle and pulled about the holder.
Don't they fear for their souls?
Pino thought about Ralph and the black shirts wearing the hoods. I don't think men like that care about their souls, Pino said, finishing the veal. It's like they've already gone to evil, and going a little deeper won't matter. Anna gazed past Pino into the middle distance for a moment. Then she looked at him and said,
So how does an Italian boy end up driving for a powerful Nazi general?
Upset by the question, Pino said, I'm not a boy. I'm 18.
18.
How old are you?
Almost 24. Do you want some more food? Wine?
May I use the toilet first? Pino said.
Down the hall, first door on the right, she said,
and reached for the wine bottle. Pino went through the living area and into a carpeted hall dimly lit by two low-wattage bulbs. He opened the first door on the right, turned on the light, and entered a bathroom with a shower tub, tiled floor, a vanity crowded with cosmetics, and another door. He went to the second door, hesitated, and then gently tried the knob. It turned. The door swung open into a darkened space that smelled of Liars and his mistress so strongly that it stopped him for a moment. A warning voice in his head told him not to go on, to return to the kitchen and to Anna. He flipped on the light. In a sweeping glance, Pino saw that the general occupied the far left side of the room, which was neat and precisely arranged. Dolly's side, which was closer to Pino, resembled an ill-kept theater costume room. There were two racks of fine dresses, skirts, and blouses. Cashmere sweaters bulged from drawers. A mishmash of colorful silk scarves, several corsets, and garter belts hung from closet doors. Shoes were lined up in rows by the bed, Dolly's only surrender to order. Beyond them, amid stacks of books and hat boxes, was an occasional table that supported a large open jewelry box. Pino went to the neater side of the room first, scanning the top of a set of drawers and seeing cufflinks on a tray, a clothes brush, a shoehorn, and a shaving kit. But not what he was looking for. Nothing on the nightstand or in it either. Maybe I was wrong, he thought, and then shook his head. I'm not wrong. But where would someone like Liars hide it? Pino looked under the mattress and under the bed and was about to search the general's shaving kit when he noticed something in the mirror, something in the chaos of Dolly's side of the room. Pino circled the bed, going up on tiptoes to avoid stepping on Dolly's things, and at last reached the jewelry box. Strings of pearls, gold chokers, and many, many other necklaces hung in bunches from hooks on the inside of the lid. He pushed them aside, looking for something plain, and then... there it was! Pino felt a thrill go through him as he plucked the thin chain with the key to the general's valise off a hook. He put it in his pants pocket.
What are you doing?
4. Pino spun around, his heart slamming against his chest. Anna stood in the doorway to the bathroom, her arms crossed, a glass of wine in one hand, and her face etched hard in suspicion.
Just looking around, Pino said.
In Dolly's jewelry box?
He shrugged.
Just looking.
Not just looking, Anna said angrily. I saw you put something in your pocket.
Pino didn't know what to say or do.
So you're a thief, Anna said, disgusted. I should have known.
I'm not a thief, Pino said, walking toward her.
No,
she said, taking a step back.
Then what are you?
I can't tell you. Tell me, or I'll tell Dolly where I found you. Pino didn't know what to do. He could hit her and flee, or... I'm a spy. For the Allies. Anna laughed dismissively.
A spy? You?
That made him angry.
Who better? Pino asked. I go everywhere with him.
Anna fell silent, her expression doubtful.
Tell me how you became a spy.
Pino hesitated, and then told her quickly about Casa Alpina and what he'd done there, and how his parents feared for his life and made him join the organization TOT, and the serendipitous path that had taken him from a bombed train station in Modena to a German hospital bed to the front seat of General Lyer's staff car outside his uncle's luggage store. I don't care if you believe me or not, he said at the end, but I've put my life in your hands. If Lyer's finds out, I'll die.
Anna studied him. What did you put in your pocket?
The key to his valise, Pino said. As if he'd used the key on her somehow, Anna changed in the next moment, transformed from suspicious by a slow, soft smile.
Let's open it.
Pino breathed a sigh of relief. She believed him, and she wasn't going to tell Lyers. If she was part of opening his valise and the general found out, Anna would be dead too. He said, I have other plans tonight.
What plans?
I'll show you, he said, and led her back to the kitchen. The candle still flickered on the table. He picked it up and poured a small puddle of wax on the table.
Don't do that, Anna said.
It will come right off, Pino said, fishing in his pocket and coming up with the key and chain. He freed the key from the chain, waited until the wax had congealed to the consistency of putty, and then softly pressed the key into it. Now I'll be able to make a duplicate and get into the valise any time I want, he said. Do you have a toothpick and a spatula? Looking at him in reappraisal and some wonder, Anna got him a toothpick from a cabinet. Pino gently pried the key free of the wax and then washed it in hot water. She set a spatula on the table, and he used it to separate the wax from the tabletop. He wrapped the cooling mold in tissue and put it in his shirt pocket.
Now what? Anna asked, her eyes flashing. This is exciting.
Pino grinned at her. It was exciting. I'm going to take a look in the valise and then put the key back in Dolly's jewelry box. He thought she'd like that, but instead the maid pouted her lip.
"What's the matter?" Pino asked.
"Well," she said, shrugging, "like you said, once you have the key made, you can get into the valise any time, and I was thinking we would put the key back, and then..."
"What?"
"You could kiss me," Anna said, matter-of-factly. "It's what you want, isn't it?"
Pino was going to deny it, but then said, "More than you can imagine." 5. He returned the key and shut the door to Dolly's bedroom. Anna was waiting for him in the kitchen with a funny smile on her face. She pointed at the chair. Pino sat down, and she set aside her wine glass and sat in his lap. She put her arms on his shoulders and kissed him. Holding Anna, feeling her lips so soft against his for the first time, and smelling the perfect fragrance of her, Pino felt as if a single violin were playing the first strains of a marvelous melody. The music vibrated so pleasantly through his body that he shivered. Anna broke the kiss and leaned her forehead against his.
"I thought it would be like that," she whispered.
"I prayed it would be," he said breathlessly. "The first time I saw you."
"Lucky me," Anna said, and kissed him again. Pino held her tighter, marveling at how right it all felt, as if cellos had joined the violin, like a missing part of him had been found and made more by her touch, the taste of her lips, and the gentle kindness in her eyes. He wanted nothing more than to hold her as long as God would let him. They kissed a third time. Pino nuzzled her neck, which seemed to please her.
"I want to know all about you," he murmured. "Where you come from, and..." Anna drew back a bit.
"I told you, Trieste."
"What were you like as a little girl?"
"Strange."
"No."
"My mother said so."
"What was she like?"
Anna put her finger across Pino's lips, gazed into his eyes, and said, "Someone very wise once told me that by opening our hearts, revealing our scars, we are made human and flawed and whole." He felt his brows knit.
"Okay."
"I'm not ready to reveal my scars to you. I don't want you to see me human and flawed and whole. I want this, us, to be a fantasy we can share, a diversion from the war."
Pino reached out to stroke her face. "A beautiful fantasy, a wonderful diversion." Anna kissed him a fourth time. Pino thought he heard a woodwind join the strings vibrating in his chest, and his mind and body were reduced to one thing, to the music of Anna Marta. And nothing more.
Chapter 19. 1. When General Lyers and Dolly returned from dinner, Pino sat on the front hall bench, beaming.
"Have you been sitting there 2 hours? Lyers asked.
Amused and drunk, Dolly eyed Pino.
"That would be a tragedy for Anna."
Pino blushed and looked away from Dolly, who chuckled and sashayed past him.
"You can go, Vorarbeiter," Lyers said. "Drop the Daimler at the pool and be back here at 0600 hours.
"Oui, mon général."
Driving the Daimler through the streets as the curfew approached, Pino couldn't help thinking that he had just had the best evening of his life, at the tail end of the worst day of his life. He'd experienced every emotion possible in a span of 12 hours, from horror to grief to kissing Anna. She was almost 6 years older, it was true, but he didn't care in the least. If anything, it made her more magnetic. As Pino walked back to the Lella's apartment on Corso Matteotti, after leaving the staff car at the motor pool, his mind once again lurched between the emotions of seeing Tullio die and the music he'd felt kissing Anna. Riding the birdcage elevator past the Nazi sentries, he thought, God giveth, and God taketh away. Sometimes in the same day. Unless he was up playing music with a group of friends, Pino's father usually went to bed early. So Pino opened the front door to the apartment, expecting a light to be left on for him and the place quiet. But the lights were blazing behind the blackout curtains, and on the floor were suitcases he recognized.
Mimo! He cried softly. Mimo, are you here?
His brother came out from the kitchen, grinning as he ran over and grabbed Pino in a bear hug. His little brother might have grown an inch, but he'd certainly filled out in the 15 weeks since Pino left Casa Alpina. Pino could feel the thick cables of muscle in Mimo's arms and back.
Great to see you, Pino, Mimo said. Really great.
What are you doing here?
Mimo lowered his voice.
I told Papa that I wanted to come home for a short while, but the truth is, as much good as we were doing at Casa Alpina, I couldn't take it anymore, being up there hiding while the real fighting was going on down here.
What are you going to do? Join the partisans?
Yes.
You're too young. Papa won't let you.
Papa won't know unless you tell him. Pino studied his brother, marveling at his audacity. Just 15 years old, he seemed to fear nothing, throwing himself into every situation without a shred of doubt. But joining a guerrilla group to fight the Nazis could be tempting fate. He watched the blood drain from Mimo's face before his brother pointed a shaky finger at the red band and the swastika sticking from his pocket and said,
What is that?
Oh, Pino said. It's part of my uniform, but it's not what you think.
How isn't it what I think? Mimo said angrily, backing up to take in the entire uniform.
Are you fighting for the Nazis, Pino?
Fighting? No, he said. I'm a driver, that's it.
For the Germans?
Yes.
Mimo looked like he wanted to spit.
Why aren't you fighting for the resistance, for Italy?
Pino hesitated, and then said,
Because I would have to desert, which would make me a deserter. The Nazis are shooting deserters these days, or hadn't you heard?
So you're telling me that you're a Nazi, a traitor to Italy?
It's not so black and white.
Sure it is, Mimo said, shouting at him.
It was Uncle Albert and Mama's idea, Pino shouted back. They wanted to save me from the Russian front, so I joined this thing, the OT, the Organization Tot. They build things. I just drive an officer around, waiting for the war to be over.
Quiet, their father said, coming into the room. The sentries downstairs will hear you.
Is it true, Papa? Mimo said in a forced whisper. Pino wears a Nazi uniform to ride out the war while other people step up and free Italy?
I wouldn't put it like that, Michele said. But yes, your mother, Uncle Albert, and I thought it best. That didn't mollify his second son. Mimo sneered at his older brother.
Who would have thought it? Pino Lella, taking the coward's way out.
Pino hit Mimo so hard and so fast, he broke his brother's nose and dropped him to the floor.
You have no idea what you're talking about, Pino said. None at all.
Stop it, Michele said, getting between them. Don't hit him again.
Mimo looked down at the blood in his hand and then at Pino with contempt.
Go ahead and try to beat me down, my Nazi brother. It's the only thing you Germans know how to do.
Pino wanted to bash his brother's face in while telling him about the things he'd seen and done already in the name of Italy. But he couldn't.
Believe what you want to believe, Pino said, and walked away.
Kraut! Mimo called after him. Adolf's little boy gonna be safe and sound?
Shaking, Pino shut his bedroom door and locked it. He stripped, got into bed, and set the alarm on his clock. He turned off the light, felt his bruised knuckles, and lay there, thinking that life had swung hard against him again. Was this what God wanted for him? To lose a hero, find love, and endure his brother's scorn all in one day? For the third night in a row, the whirlwind of his mind finally slowed on memories of Anna, and he drifted to sleep. 2. 15 days later, a Waffen-SS soldier lashed a team of 6 mules dragging 2 heavy cannons up a steep, arid mountainside. The whip laid open the flanks of the mules, and they brayed in pain and fear, dug in their hooves, and kicked up a dust cloud as they climbed toward the heights of the Apennine Mountains, north of the town of Arezzo, in central Italy.
"Get around them and be quick about it, Vorarbeiter," General Lyer said, looking up from his work in the back seat. "I've got cement pouring."
"Oui, mon général," Pino said, pulling around the mules and accelerating. He yawned and yawned again, feeling so tired he could have lain right down in the mud and slept. The pace at which Liars worked and traveled was stupefying. In the days after the executions in the Piazzale Loreto, he and Pino were on the road 14, 15, sometimes 16 hours a day. Liars liked to travel at night when possible, with slit canvas blinders over the headlights. Pino had to concentrate for hours on end, keeping the Daimler on the road with only slivers of light to navigate by. When he passed the poor mules, it was past 2 in the afternoon, and he'd been driving since long before dawn. He was further irritated by the fact that the constant movement had hardly left him a moment to be alone with Anna, since they'd kissed in the kitchen. He couldn't stop thinking about her. How it had felt when she was in his arms, her lips against his. He yawned, but smiled at the happy thought.
"Up there," General Lyers said, pointing through the windshield into rugged, dry terrain.
Pino drove the Daimler until big rocks and boulders blocked the way.
"We'll walk from here," Lyers said.
Pino got out and opened the back door. The general exited and said,
"Bring your notebook and pen."
Pino glanced at the valise in the back seat. He'd had the duplicate key for more than a week now, courtesy of some friend of Uncle Albert's, but he'd had no chance to try it. He got the notebook and pen from under the map in the glove compartment. They climbed up through rocks and friable stones that slid around their feet before they reached the top. They were afforded a view looking over a valley framed by 2 long, connected ridges that on the map looked like a crab's open claw. To the south, there was a wide plain divided into farms and vineyards. To the north, and high on the crab's inner claw, an army of men worked in ungodly heat. Lyers walked resolutely up the ridge toward them. Pino trailed the general, stunned at the sheer number of men up and down the side of the mountain. So many they looked like ants with their hill split open, teeming and crawling all over one another. The closer they got, the ants turned human and broken and gray. 15,000 slaves, maybe more, were mixing, transporting, and pouring cement from machine gun nests and artillery platforms. They were digging and setting tank traps across the valley floor. They were running barbed wire across the flanks of the slopes and using pickaxes and shovels to burrow out places for the German infantry to use as cover. Every group of slaves had a Waffen-SS soldier who goaded them to work harder. Pino heard screaming and saw slaves beaten and whipped. Those who collapsed in the heat were dragged away by other slaves and left to fend for themselves, lying on rocks, dying in the beating sun. It seemed to Pino a scene as old as time, an update on the pharaohs who enslaved generations of men to build their tombs. Liars stopped at an overlook. He gazed down upon the vast companies of conquered men at his disposal and, at least by his facial expression, seemed unmoved by their plight. Pharaoh's slave master, Pino thought. That was what Antonio, the partisan fighter from Turin, had called Liars. The slave master himself. 3. New hatred for General Liars boiled up from deep in Pino's gut. It was incomprehensible to him that a man who'd fought against something as barbaric as the decimation at San Vittore prison could in turn rule an army of slaves without so much as a twitch of inner conflict or a tick of self-loathing. But nothing showed on Liars's face as he watched bulldozers piling tree trunks and boulders on the steep mountainsides. The general glanced at Pino, then pointed below them.
As the Allied soldiers attack, these obstacles will turn them straight into our machine guns.
Pino nodded with feigned enthusiasm.
Oui, mon général.
They walked through a girdle of interconnected machine gun nests and cannon installations, Pino following Liars and taking notes. The longer they walked and the more they saw, the more curt and agitated the general became.
"Write this down," he said. "This cement is inferior in many places, likely sabotage from Italian suppliers. Upper Valley is not fully hardened for battle. Inform Kesselring I need 10,000 more laborers."
10,000 slaves, Pino thought in disgust as he wrote. And they mean nothing to him. The general then attended a meeting with high-ranking OT and German army officers, and Pino could hear him shouting and threatening inside a command bunker. When the meeting broke up, he saw the officers shouting at their subordinates, who shouted at the men under their authority. It was like watching a wave build until it reached the Waffen-SS soldiers, who hurled the weight of Liars's demands on the shoulders of the slaves, lashing them, kicking them, driving them by any means necessary to work harder and faster. The implications were clear to Pino. The Germans expected the Allies here sooner than later. General Liars watched until he seemed satisfied with the renewed pace of the work, then said to Pino,
"We're done here."
They walked back along the mountainside. The general would pause every now and then to observe some work in progress. Otherwise, he kept on marching like some unstoppable machine. Did he have a heart, Pino wondered? A soul? They were near the path that led back to the Daimler when Pino saw a group of 7 men in gray digging and swinging pickaxes, breaking rock and shale under the watchful eye of the SS. Some of them had a ravaged and mad look about them, like a rabid dog he'd once seen. The closest slave to Pino was uphill from the others, digging weakly. He stopped, put his hands on the end of the handle, like a man who'd had enough. One of the SS soldiers started screaming at him and marching across the hill. The slave looked away and saw Pino standing there, looking down at him. His skin had turned the color of tobacco juice from the sun,
and his beard was wilder than Pino remembered it. He'd also lost too much weight. But Pino swore he was looking at Antonio, the slave he'd given water to back in the tunnel the first day he'd driven for Liars. Their gazes locked, and Pino felt both pity and shame before the SS soldier clubbed the side of the slave's head with the butt of his rifle. He dropped and rolled down the steep embankment.
Vorarbeiter!
Pino startled and looked over his shoulder. General Liars was standing about 50 meters from him, glaring back at him. With one last glance at the now unmoving slave, Pino broke into a trot toward the general, thinking that Liars was responsible. The general hadn't ordered the man struck down, but in his mind, Liars was responsible nonetheless. 4. It was past dark when Pino came through the door to Uncle Albert's sewing room.
I saw bad things today, Pino said, emotional again. I heard them, too.
Tell me, Uncle Albert said.
Pino did the best he could, describing the scene with Liars and the way the SS soldier had killed Antonio for taking a break.
They're all butchers, the SS, Uncle Albert said, looking up from his notes. Because of the reprisal edict, there are stories of atrocities every day now. At Santa Ana di Stazzema, SS troops machine-gunned, tortured, and burned 560 innocents. At Casalia, they shot down a priest on his altar and 3 old people during Mass. They took the other 147 parishioners into the church graveyard and opened fire with machine guns.
What? Pino said, stunned. Aunt Greta said,
It goes on. Just the other day, in Bardine di San Terenzo, more than 50 young Italian men, like you, Pino, were strangled with barbed wire and hung from trees.
Pino loathed them all, every single Nazi.
They have to be stopped.
There are more joining the fight against them every day, Uncle Albert said, which is why your information is so important. Could you show me on a map where you were?
I've already done it, Pino said, pulling out the general's map from the glove compartment.
Unfolding it on one of the cutting tables, he showed his uncle the light pencil marks he'd made to indicate the rough placement of the artillery, machine gun nests, armories, and ammo dumps he'd seen during the day. He pointed out where Liars had piled the debris so the Allies would alter course into machine gun fire.
In this whole area, Liars said the concrete is inferior, weak, Pino said, gesturing to the map. Liars was very concerned about it. The Allies should bomb here first. Take it out before they ever attack on the ground.
Smart, Uncle Albert said, taking notes on the longitude and latitude of the area. I'll pass it along. By the way, that tunnel you visited with Liars when you first saw the slaves, it was destroyed yesterday. Partisans waited until there were just Germans inside and then dynamited both ends.
That made Pino feel better. He actually was making a difference.
It would sure help if I could get into that valise, Pino said.
His uncle said,
You're right. In the meantime, we'll see about getting you a small camera.
Pino liked that idea. Who knows I'm a spy?
You, me, and your aunt.
And Anna, he thought, but said,
Not the Allies, the partisans?
They only know you by the code name I gave you.
Pino liked that idea even more.
Really? What's my code name?
Observer, Uncle Albert replied. As in, Observer notes machine gun nests at such and such position, and Observer notes troop supplies heading south. It's deliberately bland. That way, if the Germans ever intercepted the reports, they'd have no clue to your identity.
Observer, Pino said. Plain and to the point.
Exactly my thought, Uncle Albert said, standing up from the map. You can fold the map up now, but I'd erase those pencil marks first.
5. Pino did so and left a short time later. Hungry and tired, he started toward home at first, but he hadn't seen Anna in days, and he walked to Dolly's apartment building instead. As soon as he got there, he wondered why he'd come. It was almost curfew, and he couldn't just go up, knock on the door, and ask to see her, could he? The general had ordered him to go home and sleep. He was about to leave when he remembered Anna saying that there was a back stairway just beyond her room off the kitchen. He went around the building, thankful for the moon overhead, and picked his way to where he figured Anna's room and window were, 3 stories above him. Would she be in there? Or still cleaning dishes and washing Dolly's clothes? Picking up a small handful of pebbles, he leaned back and threw them all at once, figuring she was either in there or not. 10 seconds went by, then another 10. He was about to leave when he heard the window sash go up.
Anna! He called softly.
Pino? She called softly back.
Let me in the back way.
The general and Dolly are still here, she said, doubt in her voice.
We'll be quiet.
There was a long pause, and then she said,
Give me a minute.
After she'd opened the utility door, they crept up the back stairs, Anna in the lead, stopping every few steps to listen. At last, they reached her bedroom.
I'm hungry, Pino whispered.
She opened her door, pushed him inside, and whispered back,
I'll find you something to eat, but you must stay here, and be quiet.
She was back soon with leftovers from a ham hock and a fried noodle dish that was the general's favorite. He ate it all by the light of a single candle Anna had burning. She sat on the bed, drank wine, and watched him eat.
That makes my tummy happy, he said when he'd finished.
Good, Anna said. I'm a student of happiness, you know. It's all I really want. Happiness every day for the rest of my life. Sometimes happiness comes to us, but usually you have to seek it out. I read that somewhere.
And that's all you want? Happiness?
What could be better?
How do you find happiness?
Anna paused, then said, You start by looking right around you for the blessings you have. When you find them, be grateful.
Father Ray says the same thing, Pino said. He says to give thanks for every day, no matter how flawed, and to have faith in God and a better tomorrow.
Anna smiled. The first part's right. I don't know about the second.
Why?
I've been disappointed too many times when it comes to better tomorrows, she said, and then kissed him. He took her in his arms and kissed her back. Then they heard arguing through the walls, Lyers and Dolly.
What are they fighting about? Pino whispered.
What they always fight about, his wife back in Berlin. And now, Pino, you have to go.
Really? Go on now, she said.
Then she kissed him and smiled.
6. On September 1st, 1944, the British 8th Army punctured the weaker sections of the Gothic line on the Crab Claw Ridges north of Arezzo, and then turned east toward the Adriatic coast. The fighting turned vicious. Some of the most intense of the war in Italy, after Monte Cassino and Anzio, the Allies rained more than 1 million mortar and cannon rounds on all the fortifications that separated them from the coastal city of Rimini. 9 brutal days later, the U.S. 5th Army drove the Nazis off the highlands at the Giogo Pass, and the British intensified their assault of the east end of the Gothic line. The Allies rolled north